Book Dreams, a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
Welcome to our latest Book Dreams bonus episode. I'm Julie Sternberg, here as always with Eve Yohalam. It's been a couple of months since our last episode. In fact, I don't think we've ever gone this long between episodes before.
No, we haven't. And let's never do it again. I miss talking books with you here.
Me too.
Yeah. But while we haven't been podcasting about books we've read, we have been talking about books together almost every day.
True.
So longtime listeners of Book Dreams may recall that in our earliest days, way back in 2020, we did a bunch of different episodes where we talked to bookstore owners about what it was like to own and run a bookstore. We did it because it's been a dream of ours to own a bookstore of our own.
Yes, and that dream is still burning brighter than ever. So much so that last month, Eve and I traveled to Amelia Island in Florida to attend a three-day bookstore boot camp led by Donna Paz Kaufman and Mark Kaufman of Story and Song Bookstore. It was fantastic.
It was heaven.
Yes. Three full days of inventory management, profit margins, furniture leases, labor costs.
I have chills just thinking about it.
It was truly, truly wonderful. But we thought that that dose of reality might throw some cold water on our burning dream. And instead, it got us more excited. Now we're diving deeper into the numbers and setting up conversations with various folks in the know, trying to figure out whether we can actually make this happen. So stay tuned for updates. For now, what have you been reading lately?
Well, I've read a bunch of things since our last episode, because it has been a while, but there are two in particular I want to talk about today. Before I dive in, though, I have a question for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Do you believe in free will?
Eve, I hate it when you do this to me.
And also, do you have fun plans this weekend?
You ask questions that are so hard.
Okay, no, they're good. This is the meat of life.
Okay, fine. They're important. Okay, so hold on. Let me think for a second. Okay. I would say I want to believe in free will. I don't want to think that I'm some kind of puppet, you know, that there's no point in my struggling to figure out the right course because I'm going to do what I'm programmed to do anyway. At the same time, I think a vast percentage of my decision-making is shaped by circumstances that I happened to be born into. I guess even the extent to which I question my assumptions based on those circumstances, you know, based on my reading, for example, and my education, the fact that I love to read and that I have the extent of education that I've had, all of that is based to a degree on external circumstances and the brain that I was born with.
I'm sorry, but this sounds so painful. I'm so sorry I've done this to you.
That's okay.
Like the subtext is like, why are you making me grapple with this?
I love that you love these questions.
But and I love that you're willing to tolerate them. Yeah, right.
Anyway, I struggle still, even given my, you know, all of what I've just said, to make good decisions. And that struggle feels like an exercise of will. So I don't know, Eve. Also, you know, the world feels so out of control right now. I do feel like I have no control over anything that is happening. Is that a sign that there's no free will? Again, I don't know. Please make this all clear.
Okay, zero chance of that, that I'm going to make this all clear. What I'll say for myself is that I actually feel the exact opposite of you, in that I really hope there isn't free will, because then maybe I don't have to be so hard on myself about all my failures and shortcomings that I just keep repeating or can't seem to change. What mystifies me, because I can accept, you know, neurons and life experience combining to drive us to do whatever it is we do. But what mystifies me is this notion of I, as in, if there's free will, then I have the ability to make choices. But what's I? You know, I consciousness? and sorry, you just know that I like this, so just stick with me. And then we can talk about romance novels. Okay, you know, is I consciousness? And does that consciousness include anything other than neurons firing, like a soul or some kind of animating spark or special sauce, because it seems to me that believing in free will means believing that we are more than the sum of our neurological parts. And I'm totally agnostic on that score. No clue whatsoever.
I mean, come on. I thought the question of whether there was free will is hard. Now you have me wondering, what is I? Please, just tell me there is a book that helps us answer these questions. My head is hurting.
Okay, there is. There is a book. And here it is. Okay. Yes. All of this questioning that you and I are doing is a lead up to a conversation about Robert Sapolsky's latest book, which is called Determined, A Life of Science Without Free Will. Robert Sapolsky is a professor of biology and neuroscience at Stanford. He spent decades studying baboons in the wilderness in Kenya, which informed his thinking in some of his earlier books. And he's given a TED Talk. He's done a million interviews. He's, you know, scientist famous, including a particularly memorable interview, at least for me, about the toxic intersection of poverty and stress, which was on Ezra Klein's podcast, and we'll link to it in the show notes. I think you've heard that interview too.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Yeah.
He's a deep thinker, but also a deep feeler of a guy. Mm-hmm. So the basic premise of Sapolsky's new book, as its title suggests, is that we humans have no free will. Zero. He posits that every decision we make, no matter how important or how innocuous, is driven by a combination of our neurological wiring and the sum total of our life experience, which in turn, in kind of a meta way, the experience impacts our wiring. You know, every time we do things or experience things, we are actually laying down, or I'm probably using the wrong metaphor, but impacting how our neurons fire. And he goes through a ton of detailed scientific explanation that supports this theory, which I will not get into because I barely understood a lot of it. But he also includes a lot of really interesting research about how people behave when they think they have free will versus when they think they don't. And I'm just going to spoil that right now and say there isn't much difference. And if anything, atheists behave more morally than theists, which is what's not what you might expect. But anyway, then he goes on and he wrestles with the moral implications of no free will, as in, you know, what do we as a society do about the very worst kinds of criminal behavior? You know, how do you deal with Jeffrey Dahmer if you think that killing and eating people was something he had no control over? Do you hold him responsible for those actions? Because often we don't. You know, if you think about examples like a small child or somebody with a badly damaged brain causing the death of another person, which tragically does happen, we generally don't punish people in situations like that for things we believe they can't control.
Hmm. So what does Robert Sapolsky say we should do for people who commit crimes?
Well, first, he acknowledges it's really hard to shift our thinking about this. When you hear about someone like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, your first thought, his first thought is, you know, lock him up and throw away the key, or maybe kill him and feed him to the pigs, you know, something like that. Sorry to be gross. Yeah. And then also don't forget, this idea of no free will applies to our accomplishments too, like graduating from college or doing a great job on something at work or being a loving, supportive parent. You know, we like to think that that was us doing that, not just neurons and, you know, things like that. So we really, really don't want to think we have no control over these things. But when it comes to crime, Sapolsky thinks we should leave punishment and moral judgment out of it and instead think in terms of quarantining people so that the neurons and life experiences that caused them to commit a crime in the first place won't drive them to commit a similar one.
I'm not sure I understand the implications of that. Is quarantine here just another way of saying lock them up somewhere just without calling it punishment and pretending that we don't judge? Like, does he think we have control over whether we judge?
He doesn't go into great detail about how that quarantine concept could function. Mm. But he absolutely does not think that we have control over whether we judge. He says repeatedly, it's almost impossible not to judge, and very, very difficult, even for him, to remember and live by the idea of an absence of free will. But he has described this book as a call. He strongly urges us to at least consider the possibility that there's no free will and what that implies. Because if you believe that, the logic takes you to a more compassionate and theoretically more fair approach to what we consider criminal activity.
These are all fascinating questions, and I'm really impressed that you're able to delve into them right now. I don't think that I need any more reason to sit around thinking we all have no free will anyway. what's going to be is what's going to be. Just take another handful of potato chips, Julie, and, you know, zone out in front of Law and Order because you're programmed to do it anyway. Like, I don't think so. That's what
no,
I mean.
No, fair. Yeah. But what about a reason to think, you know what, you, Julie, are doing your best, and the ways in which you fall short aren't just failures of willpower or morals?
I mean, that is a nice positive spin, and I will try to embrace it.
Excellent. Please do. All right. I just want to add one PS to this free will chat. I happened to meet Mark Epstein at a party recently. We interviewed Mark in episode 123, and I was so excited to get to meet him in person. Mark is a psychiatrist and a Zen practitioner who's written a number of books, including The Zen of Buddhism, Uncovering a Hidden Kindness in Life. So Mark and I are chatting about books we'd read recently. And when I mentioned this new one of Robert Sapolsky's, Mark got really upset. He was familiar with the premise. He hadn't read the book, but he was definitely familiar with the premise. And he said it is absolutely 100% not true that there is no free will. Complete rubbish. And it was really striking because Mark is usually so genial and mellow. But I think it speaks to how hard it is and how antithetical it is to what we as a culture value to accept or even contemplate that free will doesn't exist.
I'm glad that we have Zen Mark fighting for free will. I wonder what Buddhism has to say about it.
Yeah.
Now you're making me wonder whether he would come back on Book Dreams to chat about this. But let's table that for now. Did you say that there's another book you want to talk about?
Yeah, I just want to briefly mention Helen Oyoyemi's new book, Parasol Against the Axe. I'm a huge Helen Oyoyemi fan, and I just want to give her a shout out here for listeners who aren't familiar with her books. She was born in Nigeria, raised in London, and now lives in Prague. Prague is actually the narrator of Parasol Against the Axe. But just generally speaking, her novels are brilliant and singular and playful and deep and funny and always full of surprise. Some of her books lean toward the experimental, and they're always unconventional. So I have to confess, though, that I didn't love Parasol Against the Axe as much as I wanted to, but I did love two of her other books, Boy Snowbird and Gingerbread, and I really urge everybody to read them if you haven't already. So I think that's enough for me and my hard questions.
Never. Well, yes, that.
Yes. So what have you been reading, Julie?
Actually, I read one novel that does raise big philosophical questions, including how much we should fight against fate.
Oh, okay. So, not just me.
Well, the novel raised the question. All I had to do was read it. No one asked me to answer it.
But you read it, so you were interested in it.
And how strange that it turns out to be a common theme. We had no idea.
Kismet.
Could be. This novel is called The Other Valley, and it's by Scott Alexander Howard. Okay, here's the premise. Our main character, Odile, lives in a town overlooking a valley. To the west lies the very same town, but it's 20 years in the past. And to the east of Odile is, again, the very same town, but this time 20 years in the future. And the borders between these towns are very heavily guarded.
Okay, I'm on board with this premise.
Yeah, it's
you've got
cool,
me.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's a cool premise. At the beginning of the book, Odile is 16. She's applying to become part of the team who get to decide which individuals are allowed to cross the borders. If you pass into the future or the past, you risk changing many people's entire lifetimes with ripple effects and possibly causing some never to come into existence at all.
Right.
So the society has safeguards in place to try to make sure you don't do that, but the risks remain. And the question, one of the many kind of philosophical questions that's addressed is, who should be allowed to put others at risk in this way?
Hmm.
You know, what cause is powerful enough for that individual? So Odile's life is changed when she's 16 because one of those visitations from the future goes awry. In the second half of the book, she's 36, so 20 years in the future.
So she doesn't get wiped out when that happens.
She doesn't get wiped out. No, only in Game of Thrones is the main character constantly killed off.
Right.
But it doesn't happen here. One plot-related question is whether she'll cross over into the valley where she's 16 to try to redirect what happened. The author of this book has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Toronto and was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, where his work focused on the relationship between memory, emotion, and literature, you can absolutely see that he's threading through thoughts about that same relationship in this novel. I really enjoyed this book. I can see that others might not. It's slow moving. Odile isn't likable a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But I thought the philosophical questions were really thought-provoking. They include, you know, turns out to be quite topically for this podcast, when we try to take a stand against fate, what is the impact of doing so for ourselves and others? And of course, was that decision to take a stand free will or was it fate? Yeah, it's interesting. So let me just say, was this novel perfect from the standpoint of character development for all of the characters? No. Did it sometimes feel like ideas were given priority over story? Yes. But the story and the world building worked well enough for me. And overall, the book felt different and interesting and memorable.
This is fascinating. I know that you don't, but I love how we're both wrestling with big ideas lately. So did reading this book influence how you think about free will?
I feel like there is a mix of fate and free will at play in both the book and in life. But I am also aware that I am not fully understanding either the book or life. So, you know, as you said, I'm just doing my best.
Yes, that's the spirit. So did you read anything else you'd like to recommend?
Yes. I highly recommend Sarah Pauli's memoir called Run Towards the Danger. In fact, I recommend going down a Sarah Pauli rabbit hole. She was a child actress. I remember her from The Sweet Hereafter. She was also in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and she played Ramona in a TV series based on the Beverly Cleary novels. Those are just a few of her roles. She's a writer and a director now. She adapted Women Talking, which is a phenomenal novel by Miriam Taves, and Pauli directed that film. She also created a documentary called Stories We Tell about secrets in her own family. I love that documentary. It has a really interesting structure, and Pauli is so thoughtful about storytelling. Then it turns out in her memoir, Run Toward Danger, she continues to reassess that the characters that we met from her family in her documentary, particularly her father. So we learn even more about what gets omitted and included in the stories that we tell, which is part of what she's trying to get across in the documentary. But you certainly don't have to watch the film before reading the memoir. In the book, she has a lot to say about being a child star and how deeply traumatic it can be. She is not in favor of child acting. Not at all. It occurs to me also, you know, we just said that Scott Alexander Howard considered the relationship between memory, emotion, and literature. In her book, Pauli writes a lot about her experience with the interplay of memory, emotion, and acting. She's so smart. She's so both introspective and also really thoughtful about societal forces. And she has led an incredibly unusual and interesting life. This memoir is a series of essays about particularly impactful moments from that life. I highly, highly recommend it and her documentary.
I'm so glad you brought up this book because I've been meaning to read Miriam Taves' book ever since I saw the movie. And now I want to read Sarah Pauli's memoir. So essentially, this is two book recs in one.
Yes, they're both wonderful. And with that, I'm going to say that is it for this Book Dreams bonus episode. We always love hearing from you. Let us know what you're reading and loving. You can reach us at contact@bookdreamspodcast.com. We're also on Instagram.
Many thanks to our producer, Gianfranco Lentini, and to our theme music composer, Maya Polsky. You can find me at evejohallam.com and Julie at juliesternberg.com. And check out the podcast website, www.bookdreamspodcast.com. Until next time, happy book dreaming.
Happy book dreaming.
Listen to Book Dreams with Julie and me.